This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, dozens of members of a notorious branch of the mafia arrested in coordinated raids across Europe. On the last scheduled sitting day for the year in Federal Parliament, I'm joined by the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen, and the family of an Aboriginal woman who died in custody speaks out ahead of a coronial inquest.
We buried our mum without knowing what had happened to her. We want people held accountable for what they did or didn't do.
You know, she's a death in custody and that's what she was fighting for. And it's like there has to be a point where enough is enough.
The Federal Environment Minister ignored critical departmental advice about a proposed development on an environmentally sensitive wetland in favour of a major party donor, according to documents obtained under Freedom of Information. The minister at the time was the current treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, and the proposal, a $1.4 billion project put forward by the Walker Corporation, would see a massive development of 3,600 apartments, a marina, a hotel and convention centre, encroaching on a Queensland wetland protected under an international treaty. Steve Kinnane from the ABC's Investigations Unit has the story.
Toondah Harbour, 30 kilometres from the centre of Brisbane, is an important wetland for endangered birds.
He was eating a minute ago. He was eating a couple of crabs.
Dr. Rob Clemens is showing me some of the critically endangered shorebirds who rely on these mudflats to fatten up before their epic journeys back to their breeding grounds in Russia and China.
They're sort of the endurance athletes of the animal kingdom.
The birds' habitats are protected by five international treaties, including the Ramsar Convention, which preserves wetlands. But a proposed development by Lang Walker's company Walker Corporation threatens to undermine that commitment. If approved, this $1.4 billion project would be built on a Ramsar site. And now a series of documents obtained by the ABC sheds new light on the behind-the-scenes manoeuvring during the approval process. In April 2016, the department wrote to Walker Corporation, making its position clear.
The department intends to advise the minister to make a decision that the proposal in its current form is clearly unacceptable.
That means the department thought the minister should strike it out straight away. But that never happened. In the year the proposal was referred to the federal government, Walker Corporation donated $225,000 to the Federal Liberal Party and $23,000 to Queensland Labor. By February 2017, the minister had not yet made a decision, and Walker's corporate advisers threatened to take the matter to the federal court, arguing to strike the project out would entail an error in law. The ABC has obtained that confidential letter. It says,
"We have instructions from Lang Walker to file and serve this originating application no later than 9 March 2017 if agreement on another process has not been reached prior."
Walker Corp never took that action, but the message was clear. In May last year, Walker Corporation withdrew its initial proposal and submitted a smaller one that still encroached on 42 hectares of the Ramsar site. Even that was deemed unacceptable by the department, who urged the minister to reject it, according to documents obtained by the Australian Conservation Foundation under Freedom of Information.
The department considers the impacts of the proposed development will result in permanent and irreversible damage to the ecological character of the Moreton Bay Ramsar wetland.
But the then Minister Josh Frydenberg rejected that advice. He circled, not agreed, signed it, and deemed the proposal a controlled action, sending it to an environmental assessment known as an EIS. The project had not been approved, but it had got past that critical first hurdle. The CEO of the ACF, Kelly O'Shaughnessy, says she's shocked by that decision and believes there's now a good chance it will be approved.
Over 1,700 assessments that have been done under the EPBC Act, only 11 have been rejected over that time.
Josh Frydenberg was unavailable for interview. In a statement, he said,
"Consistent with the EPBC Act, the government decided to allow for a more detailed assessment of the proposal, including its potential impact on the wetland."
Lang Walker was also unavailable for interview. I spoke to Craig Adley from Walker Corp in Brisbane.
It has been a lengthy process to get to this point of starting the EIS, and regardless of some of those issues, all the decisions on this project need to be based on the science and the facts.
That's Craig Adley from Walker Corp ending Steve Kinnane's report. And you can hear the full investigation on Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts from. And the Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, has just responded to that report.
Actually, what is important is to have faith in the process. And every case is
different. Well, that's where the faith falls down when you know that a high-profile donor is involved.
Well, it's nothing to do with the donor. This has got
nothing to... Public opinion might vary on that, Minister.
Well, if you want to beat it up, Virginia, then, you know, maybe you could try to sway some people. But the reality is, in Steve's story, he did not make one mention of the very public advocacy from the Palaszczuk Labor government and Jackie Trad out there with the local council promoting jobs in the area. These are sensitive wetlands. I'm the first to acknowledge that. This is a Ramsar-listed wetlands with migratory species, including dolphins, turtles, birds and the like. And you have to proceed very carefully. All I was doing under the EPBC Act was to enable an opportunity for a proper assessment. I think it's only fair that you understand that context and you try not to beat this up in a one-way story.
That's the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, speaking there with Virginia Trioli on ABC Breakfast. Today is the last scheduled sitting day of Federal Parliament and the government looks like it will head into the break without a solution on discrimination laws to protect gay students and possibly defeat from a multi-party effort to bring about faster medical treatment for asylum seekers on Manus Island and Nauru. The government is working on its mid-year budget update to be delivered in under 2 weeks. The latest national accounts figures released yesterday show that consumer spending has drastically slowed, prompting some economists to predict that maybe the Reserve Bank's next move might be to cut interest rates further and not lift them. To discuss that and possible implications on his party's policies, I was joined a short time ago by the Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Sabra.
Household spending has slowed. Consumers aren't buying non-essential items. Add in falling house prices, falling share prices, the uncertainty over the US-China trade war. Australians perhaps are preparing for a tough year ahead.
Well, these were disappointing figures. We should never be alarmist in our remarks, but these were disappointing figures, no doubt about it. We're growing slower than many comparable countries on a quarterly basis, United States, New Zealand, even the UK, which is grappling with Brexit. We're growing slower, more slowly than them. And as you correctly point out, consumer spending growth at its lowest level in 6 years. And perhaps most concerningly of all, Sabra, household savings rates at their lowest rate in 10 years. Now, dipping into household savings has been one of the things which has driven recent economic growth, and it's fair comment to say that has probably reached the end of the road. Household savings are probably as low as they can go, and so that source of growth is evaporating, and it's not a good or sustainable source of growth to start with, frankly. So these are cause for concern. I think what we're seeing is, frankly, an impact of the instability and dysfunction here in Canberra on people's spending, people concerned about the lack of economic agenda of the government. And it's, I think, a reminder that we need to return stability and certainty to federal government policymaking.
All right, what happens then? Labor wins the next federal election. The suite of policies that you've promised to introduce, the negative gearing changes, the franking credit changes, they're some of the policies that you've promised to introduce. How is that, those things, not another handbrake on the economy?
Well, they're carefully designed policies, which are part of our broader sweep of measures designed to return the budget to bigger surpluses, to provide a bigger buffer for potential economic headwinds coming our way. That's important. We need bigger budget surpluses than the current government is proposing. We also need to invest in schools and hospitals, which we're doing. We also need to provide bigger tax cuts.
If I could just finish that point,
bigger tax cuts for the 10 million Australians who earn less than $125,000, which only a shortened Labor government will deliver. People are doing it tough. I mean, wages aren't keeping up with prices, whether it's electricity prices, private health insurance, whatever it is. Wages growth does remain anemic, despite the government claiming mission accomplished. Wages are okay. Wages are not okay.
And consumers may not start spending once Labor wins government.
Well, look, there's always, in the lead up to any federal election, there's always, you know, some, if you like, some response to just general political instability. But the point I'm making, Sabra, is that the Labor Party, with our stability of personnel and policy, people understand our policy agenda. We have more policies to announce, of course, but we have a a well-designed, very comprehensive, detailed policy agenda for which we're seeking a mandate. Now, that means we don't need to engage in a sort of knee-jerk, sharp policy responses that we've seen as late as last night from this government.
We'll get to that in a tick.
I mean, just the policy dysfunction at the heart of this government and the breach of proper processes for a nominally conservative government is breathtaking. It is a nadir of policymaking in this country.
With the negative gearing changes, they're slated to start on July the 1st next year. If Labor wins a May election, it leaves very little time to get those changes through Parliament. How will you achieve that?
Well, what I've indicated repeatedly on the record, Sabra, in other interviews, is that, of course, we'll have more to say about the start date of particular negative gearing reforms in particular. All existing negative gearing is grandfathered, so that's an important point that we should always remind people that all existing investments are protected. And there are some implementations.
But might you have to push off the start date?
Well, Sabra, we don't know what the date of the election is. I know the Prime Minister says it's May 18. It might be March 2, as Malcolm Turnbull rather spectacularly intervened in the discussion earlier in the week on your network. So once we have more indication of the election date, of course, then we can provide further implementation details in terms of how we intend to get that through the Parliament.
All right. On that big stick energy legislation that you were hinting at just before, to break up energy companies if they don't lower their power prices. The Coalition has put in place some thresholds, apparently. It will only happen after the consumer watchdog has sanctioned the companies and the courts will have the final decision, not a minister. The lower house crossbenchers sound like they're going to support this.
Well, Sabra, let's just go to the basics here. This is appallingly poor policy, appallingly poorly implemented. I mean, this is an unprecedented intervention. Now, you're right. The government originally said the treasurer would have the power to order a power company to divest an asset. Now, they've changed that in the face of very strong advice that was probably unconstitutional and a Liberal Party revolt.
And to the point, the crossbenchers look
like that's a matter for them. I can only speak for my party, Sabra, and my party will stand for good policy. And to make a bad situation worse, they rewrote the policy overnight, changed the legislation, and then walked into the Parliament and introduced the legislation and demanded an immediate vote before anybody in the Parliament or outside the Parliament had read the legislation. I mean, the parliamentary procedure that a piece of legislation should be considered before it's voted on is an important one. This government, in their desperation, has thrown it out. We are asked to vote on legislation today. No Liberal member has read the legislation, apart from probably the Treasurer. The Labor Party hasn't had a chance to examine it properly. The industry certainly hasn't. They didn't see it until last night, and the government moved to bring it on for a debate and vote immediately. That is shameful, Sabra. Shameful.
Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen, thanks for joining the program this morning.
Nice to talk to you, Sabra.
And as mentioned just then with Chris Bowen, the nation's growth rate came in lower than expected yesterday, with at least two prominent economists now speculating that Reserve Bank might cut official interest rates as it confronts the combination of falling house prices and tighter lending conditions. The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan joins me now. And Peter, how seriously is the rate cut view being taken, given Australia's enviable status of having 27 years of unbroken economic growth?
Well, Sarah, it's sounding like a real possibility, even though that growth record remains intact, even after a surprise slowing in the most recent quarter with growth of just 0.3% and 2.8% over the year. Remember, last month the Reserve Bank was actually predicting solid growth of around 3.5%. As we heard, the problem is that falling real estate values in the big markets of Sydney and Melbourne have really damaged perceptions of personal household wealth, so households are trimming budgets, cutting back on discretionary items, banks tightening lending standards as a result of fallout from the Royal Commission and action by the banking regulator APRA to limit investor lending. But there are also some concerns that the slowing economy might also put pressure on predictions of a surplus in next year's pre-election budget. Stephen Kakoulis, Managing Director of Market Economics, says although the Reserve Bank has been tipping the next move will be up, RBA Governor Dr. Philip Lowe will change his mind and cut when the facts begin to change.
Look, they're made up of mere mortals. They're human beings who prepare these forecasts. And they've shown that over the last, 25, 30 years, that when the economy changes, they change their view. So, look, it isn't about face. It's not to be necessarily critical of them. But for the moment, it looks as if they've been too optimistic on growth, too optimistic on inflation getting back into the target. And another quarter like the one we saw yesterday will probably force them to change their view and trim rates.
And do you have any timeline on when they might look at doing that?
If we think about May, they'll have had another two quarters of inflation numbers. They'll have had another, obviously, 5 or 6 months of unemployment numbers, which is likely to creep up a little. And, of course, they'll be assessing what's happening in this global economy.
And what impact would this have on budget predictions, given that we have an election coming up next year?
Oh, look, that's the really interesting thing, because as we've been hearing from the government at the moment, that the revenue was flooding into the coffers and they were on track to reach a surplus, and they still might be. But all it will take is for another quarter or two of softer economic growth, then all of a sudden that return to surplus will be more problematic.
And that's economist Stephen Kokoulis of Market Economics there. And Peter, there'll be another snapshot on consumer sentiment later this morning, and that might well add to the rate cut predictions.
Yes, so we'll be seeing our retail sales for the month of October. They're expected to come in with sluggish growth of just 0.2%, so not great news in the lead up to Christmas.
The ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, thank you. You're listening to AM, where it's 8:15. New data is being released today at the climate change talks in Poland, showing progress is not being made on reducing carbon emissions from fossil fuels. The Australian Government Scientific Research Organisation, the CSIRO, will tell the conference that global carbon emissions are tipped to hit a record high this year, despite countries like Australia promising to make cuts. George Roberts reports.
Cars pumping petrol, trucks burning diesel, and coal firing power stations. They're some of the culprits named for global CO2 emissions going in the wrong direction. Dr. Pep Cannadel is from the Global Carbon Project at the CSIRO.
Emissions have to go down immediately. There's no longer, you know, saying over the next 3 years they need to come down, because the emission rates that are required, anywhere between 3 to 5%, are becoming unachievable.
New data to be released today by the CSIRO shows that global fossil fuel emissions are on track to reach a record high this year. Even with renewable energy take-up doubling every 4 years, it's not enough to neutralise the growth in carbon emissions. Professor Frank Yotzo from the Centre for Climate Economics and Policy at the Australian National University says Australia's not on target to meet the emissions cuts it committed to under the Paris Agreement.
That would require reductions of around about 10 million tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent per year, or about 2% of existing emissions every year without exception between now and 2030. So that is actually a very significant task.
The former president of the Australian Conservation Foundation and Griffith University Emeritus Professor is Ian Lowe. He's seen the numbers.
They're very concerning. I mean, it's clear that we're not making the progress that was envisaged in the Paris Agreement in 2015. So it's clear that nations around the world aren't doing enough to slow down climate change.
The Australian government, though, recently has said that it will meet its Paris targets. Are you saying that Australia isn't on track either?
Australia certainly isn't on track. What the government has said is that they're on target to reduce emissions from the electricity sector by 26 to 28%. But the Paris Agreement was that we would reduce our overall emissions by 26 to 28%. To meet the Paris target, we'd need to be reducing emissions from electricity by something like 60 or 70%.
Given that Australia is only 1 to 2% of global emissions, is it really going to make a difference?
That's a reasonable point, except that every country except the US and China could say exactly the same. It's all of the 1 and 2% from all of the little countries that add up to the other 60% outside the US and China.
And that's Emeritus Professor Ian Lowe speaking there with our reporter George Roberts. Tanya Day had fallen asleep on a train in country Victoria when she was arrested for public drunkenness in December last year. Hours later, she left police custody in an ambulance as she was falling unconscious and never woke up. By Christmas, she was dead. Almost three decades after the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody recommended that public drunkenness be decriminalised, Victoria remains one of only two states where it's still an offence. Now the Day family is speaking out in a bid to have the law changed. Elise Worthington has this exclusive report.
On the banks of the Murray River at the border between Victoria and New South Wales,
The Day family has come to remember their mother.
As a Yorta Yorta woman, tradition where river people was born on the river.
Tanya Day used to come here to reflect, often with her son Warren.
She wouldn't say much, actually wouldn't even speak. She would sit here and have her own quiet time.
Daughter Belinda says there was pain in those quiet times.
Yeah, so mum's had struggles with drinking in the past. She's certainly had gone through trauma. She wanted to make her life better. So that started with, you know, eating well, looking after herself.
Tanya's Facebook page is filled with smiling selfies snapped during her frequent sessions at the gym. The active mother and grandmother had also become an advocate for Indigenous Australians and was particularly passionate about preventing deaths in custody. But her daughter says she died in the very same system she was fighting.
It was the 5th of December, so last year. You know, basically got a phone call. The Castlemaine police had been in contact. They'd actually picked mum up off the train for being intoxicated and without a ticket. I know for a fact she bought a ticket. I've checked her bank statement.
Police arrested Tanya Day for public drunkenness and took her to the watch house to sober up. Daughter April says the next time they saw her, she was in hospital.
She was on the bed and she had tubes and she was strapped down, but it was the bruise that was on her head that was most noticeable, because I thought to myself, for it to be that big and that black, she must have really hurt herself.
A directions hearing to begin the coronial inquest into Tanya Day's death gets underway in Melbourne today. It will examine whether a fall Tanya had while in custody led to her death and whether she was monitored appropriately while in the cell. Victoria Police said as the matter is before the coroner, it would be inappropriate to comment. Belinda Day says the family wants answers.
We buried our mum without knowing what had happened to her. We want people held accountable for what they did or didn't do.
Abolishing the crime of public drunkenness was one of the recommendations of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody in 1991, but it's still an offence in Queensland and Victoria. The last story Tanya Day posted on Facebook was about the death of an Indigenous man who was held in Tamworth Correctional Centre. Now she joins him as one of the hundreds of Indigenous people who've died in custody since the Royal Commission almost 30 years ago.
We think about that a lot, you know, that we are now one of those families that Mum would have been advocating for, and that, you know, it hurts knowing that she is now in that, you know, she's a death in custody and that's what she was fighting for. And it's like there has to be a point where enough is enough.
That's Belinda Day ending that report from Elise Worthington. Police officers across Europe have joined forces targeting members of a notorious branch of the mafia in simultaneous raids. About 90 people have been arrested in the sting, which comes after a lengthy investigation into the powerful Italian group. Officials have described the operation as unprecedented and extraordinary, as Thomas Aredi reports.
Hundreds of police officers were involved in the raids across Germany, Italy, Belgium and the Netherlands.
Policy!
Their target, the 'Ndrangheta, a branch of the Italian mafia with roots in Calabria in southern Italy. But the group's reach extends far beyond there. Federico Caffiero de Rajo is an Italian anti-mafia national prosecutor.
Noi speriamo che...
We hope that people will understand that 'Ndrangheta is an organisation that silently enters countries and pollutes them.
Police arrested about 90 people, but prosecutors warn this hardly spells the end of a group accused of being one of the most powerful criminal organisations in the world.
I wanted to underline once again how 'Ndrangheta has cells that operate, cooperating amongst each other, and in a network that covers the whole of Europe. If we think we have dismantled 'Ndrangheta with this operation, we're probably, actually, certainly, we are wrong.
It comes after a two-year investigation coordinated by Eurojust, the European prosecution agency that fights cross-border organised crime. Filippo Spezia is the group's vice president.
This extraordinary result has been achieved thanks to the European approach that all the concerned authorities decide to confer to give to this case. This is a model to follow also in the future.
While the Sicilian Mafia has been made famous in Hollywood films, it's the 'Ndrangheta that's believed to control most of Europe's cocaine trade. And according to investigators, the proceeds from the drugs are laundered in businesses including restaurants and ice cream parlours. Professor Antonio Nicazzo is an expert on organised crime who's published 30 books on the Mafia.
The 'Ndrangheta is the world's most powerful, least known Italian mafia criminal organization. They are trying to be invisible. Once a prosecutor in the United States said that the 'Ndrangheta is invisible, like the dark side of the moon. When the 'Ndrangheta doesn't use violence, does not attract attention from media and police, and that's the strategy.
And he says the drug trade in Europe is big business.
The 'Ndrangheta annually make more than the Deutsche Bank and McDonald's put together. With the turnout of 50 billion euros, you could clearly understand that those money attract many people, especially in Europe. And 'Ndrangheta is investing more in Europe than Italy.
The operation comes a day after Italian police arrested the suspected new head of the Sicilian Mafia, along with 45 of his alleged associates.
Thomas Arretti reporting there. The former US President George H.W. Bush has been honoured at a state funeral in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Among the mourners were five presidents, including the current resident of the White House, who's previously sparred with the Bush family. President George W. Bush delivered the eulogy, and the Governor-General, Sir Peter Cosgrove, was there representing Australia. North America correspondent Connor Duffy reports.
As his father's flag-draped coffin was carried past cannons and into the National Cathedral, President George W. Bush was visibly emotional. He delivered a moving eulogy, telling mourners his father was in heaven with his wife Barbara and daughter Robin, who died aged 3.
So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
The Bush family were praised for their grace in inviting President Donald Trump, who has sparred and at times viciously attacked many members of the family. Inside the cathedral, he and Melania Trump were seated next to President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. It was a powerful, if awkward, row that also included Presidents Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Jimmy Carter, as well as his wife, Rosalynn Carter. It was a rare moment of national unity as President George W. Bush remembered his father in an address that was filled with sadness as well as joy.
In his 90s, he took great delight when his closest pal, James A. Baker, smuggled a bottle of Grey Goose vodka into his hospital room. Apparently it paired well with the steak Baker had delivered from Morton's.
A day of national mourning was declared, with all federal employees given the day off. The Bush family, though, want this day to be a celebration of a life richly lived for 94 years. As well as serving as president, George Bush was a World War II veteran, vice president, CIA chief, congressman and diplomat. Historian John Meacham told the mourners Mr. Bush's life was defined by surviving being shot down while flying as a fighter pilot in World War II.
The rest of his life was a perennial effort to prove himself worthy of his salvation.
His life code, as he said, was tell the truth, don't blame people, be strong, do your best, try hard, forgive, stay the course. And that was and is the most American of creeds.
He was also a committed family man and enjoyed 73 years of marriage to Barbara Bush and is survived by 5 children. He often said he didn't know where he'd be without friends and family, a point honoured by former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney.
There are wooden ships. There are sailing ships. There are ships that sail the sea. But the best ships are friendships, and may they always be.
Mr. Bush's casket will now be returned to Texas for burial. This is Connor Duffy in Washington for AM.
And US markets are closed as Americans mourn the death of President H.W. Bush. Earlier, stocks across Europe ended sharply weaker on lingering worries about trade tensions between the US and China. The Australian dollar is weaker too this morning after yesterday's lower than expected national accounts figures. This morning, it's trading at 72.6 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It's 8:30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.